Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. They say that to err is to be human. And a long time ago, Irish author James Joyce said, mistakes are the portals of discovery. Now, we know that to be true. We know that intellectually. Many products, in fact, on the market today were brought about as the result of an error or a failure. And I think the most classic example there is the Post-it note. I don't know if you know that story, but I think it was in the 70s, Spencer Silver, a scientist at the 3M Research Laboratories, he was working on trying to find a stronger glue. And he developed this new adhesive, thought it was fantastic, but it actually turned out to be weaker than the one that 3M already used. And so he found that it stuck to objects, but it could easily be pulled off. And so it was put to one side. About 4 years later, another 3M scientist, Arthur Fry, was singing in the choir at church, as he usually did, and he used markers in his hymn book to keep his place, but they kept falling out on the floor. And so he kept thinking there has to be a better way. And then he suddenly remembered this glue that Spencer Silver had been working on that stuck to things, but you could lift it off. So he tested it on his hymn book markers, and lo and behold, the Post-it note was born. So when we know intellectually that it's okay to fail, it's okay to be wrong, why do so many of us find it so difficult to admit that we're wrong or we've made a mistake? That's what we're going to be exploring in the first segment today with Catherine Schultz. She's a journalist and she's written a fascinating study on being wrong, adventures in the margin of error. My second guest today shares why we as individuals and society at large must have what he calls magnificent obsessions. He's a family therapist and creativity coach, and together with his wife, Anne Maisel, Dr. Eric Maisel has written a book called Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions. He calls this a habit that can be positively life-changing. And we'll end today's show with tips from dream activist Joyce Chapman, who's realized some magnificent obsessions of her own, as well as helping thousands of others realize their magnificent obsessions. Let's bring on Catherine Schultz on Being Wrong. My guest is Catherine Schultz. She's a journalist and author with a very credible, if not necessarily enviable, as she puts it, claim to being the world's leading wrongologist. Her freelance writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, The Nation, Foreign Policy, and The Huffington Post, among others. She's the former editor of the environmental magazine Grist and a former reporter and editor for the Santiago Times of Santiago, Chile. In her new book, Catherine Schultz explores why we find it so gratifying to be right and so maddening to be mistaken, and how this attitude toward error corrodes our relationships. Her book is called Being Wrong, The Adventures in the Margin of Error. Catherine Schultz, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
This was such an interesting book, Catherine, and you have an interesting background. You currently live in Hudson Valley, New York, but you were a 2004 recipient of the Pew Fellowship in International Journalism. You've reported from Central and South America, Japan, and most recently the Middle East. I want to know how you did all that and found time to spend 5 years of your life researching the subject of being wrong.
Well, there were some busy years in there. It's funny you should bring up the travel, though, because in some ways I think my background in international journalism really helped me with this book, because one of the wonderful things about travel is that you're wrong all the time, actually. You're always out of your own context. You're always running up against your own assumptions. They're usually poorly grounded. They don't match the evidence when you actually get to a new country or a new community. And that kind of wrongness is really wonderful, and you learn a lot from it, and that's part of what got me thinking about error, not just as a really negative positive thing in our lives, which I think is how we often experience it, but also as this really tremendous source of learning and excitement and change.
You've described this as a book for everyone, and you said often people think it's a book for their spouse or for their boss. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's funny. I often get the reaction when people ask me what I'm working on, and I would say, oh, I'm writing a book about being wrong. They would say, oh, I have to get that for my husband, or I have to get that for my wife. And, you know, obviously there's a joking element in that, but I think that any time we deal very closely over a long period of time with someone, whether it's our spouse or our children or our coworkers, you're constantly making decisions, and you're constantly making judgments, and strong opinions come into conflict with each other, and we really have to hash out these issues of who's right and who's wrong. We all face these conflicts every single day, and we don't necessarily deal with them that gracefully, and it can be quite hard on those relationships, again, whether it's in your workplace or in your dining room. And in that sense, I really do think it's a book for everyone, because none of us is immune to getting into these kinds of conflicts over who's right and who's wrong.
Right, and it's been described as a book that really will change how you see being wrong. You tell stories, you draw on stories from Arctic mixed adventures to failed marriages. You examine philosophers, you examine the man on the street. Where did you begin with your research on this?
It was really quite challenging, actually, because although, you know, wrongness and error is totally omnipresent in our lives, we don't really have a category for it. We don't think about it that often, probably because we think it's going to be unpleasant. And so you can't really go to the library and, you know, look up wrong in the database and find all the information you need. You have to turn to all of these different areas. You know, there's a lot written about wrongness, but it's not under a category called wrongness. It's in science or the history of science, or it's in psychology, or it's in politics and economics. So I really did a lot of kind of trolling through huge intellectual terrains to try to see, well, how do we talk about this subject, and who does have interesting insights on it? And then, of course, I just started talking to people, because this is fundamentally a topic that's really about how we treat each other and how we treat ourselves. And it turned out that when you start talking to people about wrongness, everyone has something to say. As I said, this is a topic that's really very central to our lives in so many domains.
Yeah, I was struck. You took your video camera to Grand Central Station, just a 4 or 5 minute video there. But you asked people at the station, how do you feel when you're wrong? And some of the answers were humbled, embarrassed, like a little kid, like I'm being scolded, mad. I don't feel good. I feel frustrated. I feel defensive. Were you surprised to get such strong reactions from people?
Exactly surprised, because by that point I had talked to so many people about wrongness that I had a sense of the range of how people respond. And in some ways, unfortunately, I think the responses often do tend to cluster at the negative end of the spectrum. When you say the word wrong to people, even just that one word, it's like that big red X on your term paper or whatever. It really brings up negative emotions for people. What I was struck by was how frank people were with me, and in many cases very funny, and in many cases very thoughtful, and really had tremendously interesting things to say on the subject. And to me, that's part of what's exciting, is just this feeling of, wow, we don't talk about this, but given the chance to do so, it's suddenly a really, really interesting conversation.
And there were some people who said, one of your other questions to them was, what are you most wrong about? One woman said, I always thought I was right until I learned to play bridge. people said they were wrong about picking the wrong friends, about judging people, marriage, religion, family, and some could not answer it at all. Were you surprised by the fact that some couldn't admit it to, yes, I'm often wrong, but couldn't really pinpoint why or how?
This is actually something I find really fascinating about error, is that typically, if you ask people, if you say, oh, I'm thinking about being wrong, a lot of people will say, oh, you should interview me, I'm wrong all the time. But then when you really push a little farther and say, okay, great, you know, tell me something you've been wrong about, a surprising amount of the time people do draw a blank, as you saw people do in that Grand Central Station video. And again, I think this is where the issue is, that we don't have a cultural category called wrongness where we just put all of our mistakes and we can easily access them. We don't, as individuals, like to think about our mistakes. We sometimes have a tremendous amount of difficulty remembering them, even when they were huge, even when they really completely altered our lives. And so for me, it wasn't, again, I think I was less surprised by the people who weren't able to answer and more surprised by the people who were willing to tell a total stranger in Grand Central Station, yeah, you know, I was really wrong about my family, or I was really wrong about my religion. Those are huge confessions to make, and there was almost a kind of relief that went along, I think, with the ability to talk about it.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk about that, because you talk about beliefs, our beliefs, and religion is obviously one of our beliefs, and how they tie us to our community, and how we don't like to sometimes even question our beliefs, because it then alters our relationship with our community. So let's talk about that a little.
Sure. I think this is actually one of the things that makes it most difficult for us to consider the possibility that we're wrong about our big beliefs. You know, this, now I'm not talking about, you know, where did you put your car keys, or, you know, were you or your husband supposed to pick up the kids from school? I mean, our big overarching political, religious convictions about the world, things of that class. And in that case, it's true that we don't just hold the belief. There's a philosopher I like who says we hold a membership in a community of believers. So if we start to challenge that belief or wonder about it or have doubts about it, it's not just going to shake our sense of, you know, well, do I believe X about healthcare or Y about healthcare, or, you know, do I believe in, you know, this version of Christianity or that other version of Christianity or none of it at all. It's going to shake our entire social establishment, everything that connects us to our world, our family ties, our community ties, the neighborhood we grew up in, our memories of our childhood, all of that is going to be affected if we challenge those really deep underlying beliefs. And so the bar to rethinking our biggest convictions about the world becomes very, very high.
Mm. I was surprised by how many people, when you ask them how often are you wrong, actually said never. answers ranged from never wrong, I'm never wrong, to not often. One woman even asked her partner, can you ever remember a time when I was wrong? And others said they're wrong half the time to 70% of the time on a daily basis at home and work.
Yeah, I absolutely love that set of reactions. They're so funny, and they reveal so much about really how all over the map we are when it comes to thinking about wrongness and how deeply individual and personal our responses are. I tend to think, or at least I always did think, that people who say they're never wrong are mainly kidding, that there's an element of kind of rueful, a joke at their own expense in that answer. But the more that I've talk to people and ask them, sometimes it's not a joke. Sometimes people really have the sense that, by and large, they are right about the world. They kind of have it all together, and the mistake is really the kind of very rare exception to their life, not a daily occurrence at all. And I think that, you know, as funny and in some ways frustrating as that can be to hear as an outsider, I also have a lot of empathy for that perspective, because the reality is we need to feel like we're right just to get through the day. We can't sit around questioning every single one of our beliefs, or we're never going to get out of bed in the morning. So to some extent, it makes sense that people have this reaction of, oh, I'm never wrong about anything. But of course, again, as seen by an outsider, that seems a little bit unlikely.
One of your chapters is actually the allure of certainty, the seduction of certainty. So is that what is so alluring about it, that we wouldn't get out of bed if we doubted ourselves too much?
I think that's part of it. I think it's also the case that we really don't like to not be in control. We don't like to not know what's going to happen next. It feels very scary. It feels very disorienting. And one of the primary attractions of certainty is you don't have to entertain those fears. Now, being certain doesn't actually change the world or what's going to happen in it. It doesn't, you know, eliminate the possibility of bad events happening. It doesn't eliminate the possibility of being out of control. But you can pretend it does, and you don't have to think about it. And I think that kind of security is part of why we can be very strongly attracted to political or religious leaders who present an aspect of absolute assurance, why we can in ourselves decide to be just immensely, unshakably full of conviction and refuse to entertain doubt. because it just staves off some of the, you know, real terror of not fundamentally being in control of our lives.
Mm. So is that, you have a chapter on knowing, not knowing, and making it up. Is that why somebody in an argument with a spouse, let's say that they know they're wrong, but they still insist they're right, they're not going to back down. Is that why they don't back down? They just want to be right?
Well, I think that those situations are really fascinating to me. I had a friend confess to me in the course of writing this book that often when he's arguing with his wife, he will just spontaneously start inventing facts or so-called facts. You know, they're not true, and he's already realized that he's wrong, but he'll go ahead and invent them anyway because he's going to defend that position, you know, no matter what. And I think that in that case, part of what's going on is just a kind of reflexive interpersonal desire to have the upper hand. And what's funny is it doesn't make anybody happy. It doesn't make the person who's ostensibly winning the argument happier. It certainly doesn't make the person who's losing the argument happier. People tend to raise their voices. It's not conducive to harmony at home or in the workplace, that kind of real insistence on being right. But I think, and again, in some ways, this tracks back to not thinking as a culture about wrongness. We don't have a reflex in that moment to step back. We have a reflex to escalate. And I think one of the real things that I hope people can get from this book is a capacity to, in that moment, say, you know what? You might have a point. I might be wrong here. Or, I don't know if I'm right or wrong. Let me hear you out. Because that kind of move, instead of escalating, I think can suddenly make for much more interesting and productive conversations. Even if in the end you still feel like you were right, you had a good and interesting conversation about it instead of this kind of pitched battle over made-up facts.
Right. I love the quote on your website by American poet Ogden Nash. He says, to keep your marriage brimming with love in the loving cup, whenever you're wrong, admit it. Whenever you're right, shut up.
You know, it's funny, that quote, when I came across it, I thought, why am I even writing this book? You know, Ogden Nash said it all in two lines, and much more hilariously than I ever could, as Ogden Nash always does.
Yeah, I'm a kind of a proponent lately of Dr. Phil's, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? And I've actually said that to a couple of people and actually been told both. I want to be right and I want to be happy.
Absolutely. And that's such an interesting reaction, actually, because it displays the depth of our unwillingness to let go of the experience of being right. We really think it's going to be just the be-all and end-all of existence to be right. But, you know, in some ways it's a little corny, but I'm with Dr. Phil. I think that there are moments when the big picture is, am I going to be a good person in this moment? Am I going to be a kind person? Am I going to be a curious person who wants to learn more about the world and an empathetic person who wants to be kind to others? Or am I going to decide that the most important thing is that I prove that I'm right? And I think a lot of us really get stuck in that trap.
I think we do. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Catherine Schultz. She's a journalist and author. Her new book is called Being Wrong: Adventures in the Margin of Error. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Wrong. I was born with the wrong side, in the wrong ass, with the wrong ascendancy.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
You're never too old to fulfill your dream, but sometimes we get caught at making a living instead of creating a life. If you put your dream on hold or can't figure out what to do when you grow up, tell us what's getting in your way. I'm Vicky St. Clair, and I'm excited to let you know that we've partnered with dream coach Joyce Chapman to get your questions answered on air. So tell us what's holding you back. Email your questions and challenges to info@conversationslive.net or leave a confidential voicemail at 425-269-4772. And tune into our third Monday Dream Coach series at noon Pacific on KKNW. See more information at conversationslive.net.
June 28th on Conversations Live, it's all about our connection with animals, wild and domesticated. Vicky talks with anthropologist and author Barbara J. King about being with animals, why we're obsessed with the furry, scaly, feathered creatures who populate our world. And I'll talk with author Gordon Grice about his book, Deadly Kingdom, the book of dangerous animals, about some of the world's most lethal and mysterious animals. Join us for a wild hour, Monday, noon Pacific, here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Yost, founder of The One Gathering. Join me at my healing happy hour, July 9th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the High Spot Cafe. Take in appetizers, live music, tarot card readings, seated Reiki, and massage. Silent auction items as well. Cash bar provided and only $15 at the door. Proceeds go to The One Gathering in October. See you at my healing happy hour, July 9th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the High Spot Cafe. For more details, visit theonegathering.com.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Alternative Talk 1150 is on the interwebs. Dial us up at 1150kknw.com.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Catherine Schultz. She's an author and journalist. Her new book is called Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. And Catherine spent 5 years of her life researching this very topic. So she can quite legitimately claim to be the world's leading wrongologist, as she calls it. Catherine, I want to ask you what you learned about yourself when you were putting this together.
That's an excellent question. Well, the first thing I learned was something that I had already long known, or at least suspected, which is that I'm a fairly stubborn and opinionated person, or at least I'm capable of being that person. And in fact, I think that's part of why I got interested in this book, is that I felt in my own self and in my own life this attachment to being right that we were just discussing. And I saw the way that it could escalate so quickly and turn what could have been an interesting, fun, productive conversation into something edging a little bit more, you know, a little bit closer to an argument. And I started wondering about my own attachment to being right. So certainly, I think working on this book caused me to examine my own feelings about that. And I also think it really changed me over the course of working on it. And that's part of why I feel optimistic about the possibility of this book and more generally of a cultural conversation about wrongness to actually really help people rethink how they behave in these situations. I'm not a less opinionated person than I was 5 years ago. I have a lot of ideas. I have a lot of convictions. I'm very quick to put them on the table when someone asks for them. What has changed is that I'm also very quick to acknowledge when they're provisional, when there are gaps in my information, when I might be staking a stronger claim than I really have the evidence for, and when I'm just flat out wrong. And I've really learned that that interaction, that saying, hey, maybe I'm wrong, it just instantly transforms a room. People behave completely differently towards you. It's a much more gratifying experience, and you learn a lot more.
Yeah, interesting. Let's look at what doctors, airline executives, Thomas Jefferson, let's look at what they've all understood about error, what they know about error, and how the rest of us can benefit from that.
Sure. I think what all of those folks you're citing understood about error is something that I call the paradox of error. There's a lot of domains in life where we really don't want to make mistakes. I have an overall very positive attitude about wrongness in this book. I talk a lot about the things that we can learn from it and the ways it can change us. That can be kind of an error cheerleader. But that said, there are a lot of kinds of mistakes that there's just nothing good about them. There's nothing good about a medical mistake. There's nothing good about a mistake in aviation and in countless other domains. Nobody wants to see, you know, an error at a nuclear power plant, heaven forbid. So it's very important in some domains that we really try to prevent mistakes and, if they are going to occur, mitigate whatever damage they could cause. And the reason I talk about a paradox of error is that it turns out that if your goal is to eliminate error, if you really just want there to be no mistakes at all, the only thing you can do is assume that there are going to be mistakes constantly. You have to become become obsessed with mistakes. You have to get interested in them. You have to get curious about them. You have to figure out why they happen and where they come from. And by that kind of thorough embrace of error, you are then able, probably not to eliminate mistakes, we're human, they're going to happen, but to significantly reduce them and significantly reduce the negative effects they will have if they do occur. And we've seen some industries and some individuals who've been successful at doing this. So, for instance, the aviation industry has famously set the standard in reducing error to a really remarkably low rate, enough so that, you know, we're almost all of us willing to get on an airplane, and we assume that nothing bad is going to happen. And the reason we assume that is we are almost certainly right. And the way that they've done that is they've created a culture in which it is not only permissible but mandatory to talk about mistakes when they happen. They've created a culture where when a mistake does occur, there is an exhaustive process of reviewing it, researching it, trying to understand how it happens, and putting in place mechanisms to make sure it never happens again. And I think we all stand a lot to learn from those kinds of domains like aviation when we're in a situation where we also feel like we want to prevent a mistake from happening.
Mm. If being wrong is so natural, and you do write, it's ultimately wrongness, not rightness, that can teach us who we are. You also say, I encourage us to see error as a gift in itself, a rich and irreplaceable source of humor, art, illumination, individuality, and change. Do we need to get more of a sense of humor about being wrong? Do we need to lighten up?
Absolutely. I mean, again, I'm not saying that we need to think that things like medical errors or aviation errors are in some way funny. They're not at all. But are a relatively rare and extreme category of mistakes, and we've developed an entire system for dealing with mistakes in domains like that. What we haven't developed is any kind of system for dealing with mistakes in our day-to-day lives, and that's more of what I'm focused on. And in those situations, I think probably our strongest tool is a sense of humor. I mean, if you have the capacity in the middle of an argument with your boss or your coworker or your spouse to say, you know what? I'm being kind of a ridiculous mule here. I have no idea what I'm talking about. If you can make a joke about your own sense of certainty, you will instantly diffuse and completely alter that situation. And when you have made a mistake, you know, when you've actually realized, whoops, I totally blew that one, if you're able to laugh at it, you're also going to really make things easier on yourself. You know, you won't beat yourself up for that mistake. You won't stay up at night wondering, how could I have been such an idiot? You weren't an idiot. You were human, and you got it wrong, and we all do. And a sense of humor can be very, very helpful in getting beyond that.
Mm. Well, we're almost at the end of our segment, Catherine. What would you like our listeners to take away from this conversation? If they heard nothing else, what would you like them to take away?
You know, I think I would like them to walk away realizing that wrongness is something that's fun and interesting to think about. Mainly, I think we have a very aversive reaction to wrongness. We just try to get as far away from it as possible. But in reality, when we start thinking and talking about wrongness, we get into very, very interesting conversations that can really change how we feel about ourselves and how we interact with people around us, whether that's on a personal scale or a global one.
And since you've become the expert on being wrong, tell us this. Is there or is there not a right way to load the dishwasher?
Well, you know, I've gotten around this problem by not having a dishwasher. So.
I don't have one either now. So listeners can find out more about you and the book at beingwrongbook.com. And I know you're coming up here to Seattle. What are you going to be doing up here in Seattle?
That's right. I'm going to be in Seattle at the very end of June and the beginning of July. I'm reading at two different bookstores there, one at Elliott Bay Books and the other is Third Place Books. And that will be on June 30th and July 1st. And I will be reading from the book, talking about wrongness, and fielding questions from the audience, and hopefully also fielding hilarious, interesting, fascinating stories from the audience of their own experiences with being wrong.
And I can tell you're very passionate about this. And just to let our listeners know, you'll be at Third Place Books on June 30th at 7 p.m. and Elliott Bay at 7 p.m. on July 1st. And of course, you can check out that at websites too. I thank you so much for being with us today, Catherine. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
And again, my guest, Catherine Schultz, her book, Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. You can find out more about Catherine and her work at beingwrongbook.com. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals and Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And my guest in this segment is Eric Maisel, Dr. Eric Maisel. He's a psychotherapist and the author of many books, including Coaching the Artist Within and Fearless Creating. He's a columnist for Art Calendar magazine, a creativity coach, and a trainer of coaches, and he leads workshops nationwide and online. He wrote this book, which we're going to talk about right now, called Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions, along with his wife, who's a former teacher and school administrator, Anne Maisel, and she's now engaged in researching the productive obsessions of historical and contemporary figures. That sounds kind of interesting. Dr. Eric Maisel, welcome to the show today.
Hi, Vicki. It's great to be with you.
And it's great to have you here. I read that Dr. Susan Carey is the creativity blogger for Psychology Today, and she describes your work as elegantly combining the most inspiring elements of mindfulness, engagement, focus, and flow. You say in the intro to your book, Brainstorm, that you're going to share a wonderful habit of mind that's available to us right now. So tell us, how would you describe this work to us?
Well, let me start by making a simple distinction, because people are most familiar with unproductive obsessions. In clinical practice, that's what's been talked about for 150 years, and that's because at a certain moment in time in the late 19th century, one fellow defined obsessions as unwanted, intrusive thoughts, and ever since, obsessions have been held as negative things in the therapy world. But ordinary people, scientists, creative people, have known that there's a positive side to obsessing. They've always known about productive obsessions. And so I'm just returning that idea to the table, helping people understand that there aren't only unproductive obsessions, those obsessions that are based in anxiety, but there are also productive obsessions, those obsessions that we choose, those things that interest us and that we love, that we want to really concentrate on.
And your whole premise here, Eric, is that this is how the brain wants to work. So let's take those negative obsessions, those unproductive obsessions, and turn them around and choose, as you said, what we obsess over.
Yeah, it is the way the brain wants to work, and we've kind of lost some of the language of the human potential movement from the 60s and 70s, but most of us realize that we have potential, that we have this brain that we don't utilize all that much or enough. We keep it busy. We certainly keep it occupied with all kinds of thoughts and errands and responsibilities and worries and what have you. We keep it busy, but we don't tend to really use it. And that's the idea of the book, that the brain would love to be used better if it were given the opportunity. What has to happen is that we have to quiet the brain more. We have to let go of the small thoughts that bother us so much and that occupy so much of our time. Because at a neurological level, every thought is grabbing neurons. That's what a thought is. It's the grabbing of 10 million or 100 million neurons. And so if we're having lots of small thoughts, we don't have our brain available to us. We don't have our full neuronal capacity available to us, and we can't think our bigger thoughts. So one of the basic ideas in the book is, and this is everybody knows this from both Eastern philosophy and Western cognitive psychology, it's really smart to let go of thoughts that don't serve us. And when you do that, you get your brain back, and then you can think about bigger and better things.
Yeah, this is quite fascinating, I think. I have a couple of friends. We've had discussions about this, and it seems that sometimes people want to claim creativity by saying, well, you know, my brain thinks a million things a minute. But you say if we're actually thinking that way, we're probably thinking nothing.
That's right. Because for an idea to come to fruition, it needs elaboration, it needs attention. You need to pay it attention over time. And we like to flee from our thoughts. So we find thinking pretty much anxiety provoking. That's why so many people just arrive at simple opinions rather than thinking things through. This is true of all of us. We all do that. We arrive at simple opinions rather than wanting to think things through because thinking makes us anxious. So the person who says, I have a million great thoughts and I just let them go by and that's really my sort of creativity filtering right through me, probably has not had the experience that a productive creative person has of having a thought and then sitting with it for a long time. And by a long time, I mean a long time. Beethoven was notorious for hearing some musical thread, some musical theme, maybe a folk tune, and holding on to it for decades and decades and incubating it into a symphony 35 years later. So the brain has that capability of holding on to something and working on it somewhere in consciousness while we're doing our everyday things. And that's a talent and habit of mind that most people really don't cultivate.
Yeah, and you talk about this in the book. You say that any great event, any great symphony, any great story, any great play has gone, the creator has really gone through this productive obsession.
That's right, because, I mean, if you think about it, I think it's obvious that when you start thinking about your play or your symphony or your scientific theory or your home business or anything, it morphs. It changes as you think about it. That's what thinking does. It increases our understanding of a subject. Most people don't want to stay with that process. As soon as their idea shifts, they say they badmouth themselves, and they say things like, boy, I must not really know what I'm thinking about, or I must not have any talent, or I'm not ready to be thinking about this. And they don't understand that this shifting, this morphing, is exactly the thinking process. Anybody who has tried to tackle a novel or a symphony or a scientific idea or create a business or do anything that requires that kind of intellectual integrity knows that they have to ride that wave. They have to ride the changing tides as their ideas shift and as the big idea shifts.
Yeah, I find this whole concept fascinating. I've read a lot of books on creativity from creative people, and the one that always sticks in my mind is Twyla Tharp, the choreographer. And when she begins choreographing a new production, she doesn't change the basic structure of her life, but there's a lot of things she eliminates and a lot of things she puts into place. Is that something you would call productive obsession?
Sure, she must have, and no doubt she has, a way of holding the whole thing in consciousness, which is, again, one of the things that the brain can do. It can hold a huge amount of material, and then she's trying to figure out, not consciously, but somewhere in consciousness, she's trying to figure out what in this new iteration might make it better or fresher or what have you. And you can't get to that place of wanting something to be fresher or newer or better if you don't know the thing itself, if you're not able to hold the whole thing in consciousness. So I think that's a very interesting example of how a productive obsession works. You might be only making a small change. It may look to the audience like suddenly a dancer is doing, you know, four pirouettes rather than three, but that change occurs because you've been obsessing about the whole production and what the whole idea requires.
Yeah, interesting. You have actually, you worked with a group of people online, your productive obsession group. I wonder if we could share a couple of the stories from there, just to show how this works in place. I mean, where does one begin to, let's say somebody wants to write a book or wants to start a business, where does one begin to become productively obsessed?
Well, I think the first step, and this is where I start with people in the group, the first step is what I mentioned previously, which is if you don't have your brain available, you can't really do this work. So the first step is letting go of thoughts that don't serve you. And cognitive therapists teach a pretty simple, smart, straightforward three-step process for doing that. And that's noticing what you're thinking and disputing those thoughts that don't serve you and then substituting more affirmative language. So I'm saying that quickly here, but I do that more slowly with people in the group to help them first, so to speak, clear their mind so that their neurons are available. That's a first step. The second step is trying to generate a list of what interest you or what you love. Most people are not that clear on where their passions are. They're so busy living and getting by and surviving that those things that they used to love, things that were clear loves at the age of 5 or 6 or 7, reading a book or, you know, being in nature, things that were clear loves then are muddier loves now. They've gotten submerged in the hectic lives that we live. So the second step is to generate a list of the things that interest you. And then to try to, and this is very mechanical sounding, and I don't mean it to be mechanic, but then rank order them. See which are the interests that are more interesting to you than the others at this split second. And then you need to commit to one of them, whether it's your home business or your novel or your new suite of paintings or whatever, or solving some personal problem. Whatever it is that you want to commit to, then you need to do that committing. And then you need to make space and time for the thinking. You need to get it on your calendar. Most people don't schedule thinking time. And if you want to productively obsess, you need time and solitude. You need a space with a door that closes and 45 minutes or half an hour or an hour of time to do this thinking. And when you have space and time and the object that you're thinking about, the idea that you're working on, that's the starting place. Then you have to stick with it. I ask people to stick with it for a month. I think that's a nice commitment to one's own process, to mm-hmm. stick with it for
right.
a month.
Right.
So that's the kind of the overview of the starting place.
I love in the book that you call it a magnificent obsession. I love that. I wanted to talk about two of the people that you share their stories in your book. There's a chapter 18, called The Turmoil and Calm of Process. And you talk about the Peggy and Ralph are the two people that I just wanted to touch on here. She said she was on the Productive Obsession Challenge with you, and she says at the 2-week mark, I'm living my productive obsession and experiencing personality growth and change, but not in the way I expected. I thought it might be a linear process. Instead, I was overcome by a new energy, one that's softer and gentler and urges me forward daily. And people at work noticed she smiled more, she seemed calmer. You say you can only attain this calmness if you accept the process of reality. What do you mean by that?
As I said before, people really like to avoid process. Many people will pay lip service to the word, you know, I love the process of creativity or what have you. But in fact, when you think about it, the process might mean spending 2 years on a novel that doesn't work. And when I say it that way, nobody wants that. Nobody wants the reality of process. Another way to say it is, pundits who claim to know believe that Beethoven's 1st, 3rd, 5th, 7th, and 9th symphonies are better than his 2nd, 4th, 6th, and 8th. And I have no idea if that's true, but what I know is you can't do 9 without 8, you can't do 8 without 7. You can't skip the things that don't work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what everybody wants to do. They want to skip the things that don't work. They don't want mistakes and messes. And this is perfectly sensible because in the rest of life, we're supposed to get things right. We've been supposed to be getting things right, you know, since the first grade. We've supposed to have been drawing inside the lines since the first grade. So to make this long story short, people have a hard time embracing process at a visceral level. Intellectually, they get what I'm saying. But at a visceral level, they don't really like the idea of mistakes and messes and investing time in something that might not work and all of that. But once they surrender to process, once they recognize that they have to accept the bad with the good, that if they write 30 novels, 14 may be stinkers and 16 may be excellent. You know, once they accept that reality, life really brightens up because then you're not so attached to outcomes and you can enjoy the process more.
Yeah, yeah, makes sense. Ralph was another one in your group, and he wanted to create a non-profit creative tourism business. When he finally accepted the Productive Obsession Challenge with you, he said the process was nothing like moving forward for him. It was like being in a blender and everything was whirring around all at once. You describe this as all hell breaking loose in your mind, but say a surprising existential calmness accompanies this chaos. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Sure, I think it's really interesting because two things are going on when we really bite into something. First of all, chaos happens because suddenly we're really wanting to think hard about X, whatever X is. Well, let me just flesh it out with some real example. Let's say you're in the sandwich generation and it's a personal problem you're trying to solve, and it's where how to find the best retirement home for your father, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the way most people want to do it is get a recommendation or throw a dart at the phone book and get it done quickly and not really try to figure out what's the best place. But if you bite into the question, then suddenly you have 50 different things to think about, whether it's cost or distance from you or treatment methods or, you know, anything under the sun. All of that is the chaos of actually thinking. So you start out with this chaos, which is part of the process, but simultaneously you feel proud of yourself that you're doing this. That's the existential calm, because you know that you're making meaning. You know that you're accepting the responsibilities of personal meaning making and taking on the job of finding the best retirement home for your dad. So even while the chaos is going on, you're feeling good because you know that you're making yourself proud.
Now, how do we, when we're in this productive, obsessive cycle, how do we prevent when the negative thoughts come in, which, you know, I'm sure they do, how do we turn that around and channel it back into our productive obsession? How do we channel our thinking back?
I would go back to what I said before, and that is you want to notice what you just said to yourself. That's the biggest thing, because often we'll have a stray thought like, boy, this is a stupid book I'm writing. And it'll really be a stray thought. We won't even quite notice we've said it. But suddenly, for some reason that we can't identify, we're not working on the book for the next month.
Mm.
So it's really important that we notice these stray thoughts. And sometimes they're feelings in the body, which are more complicated. And sometimes they're tricky thoughts, because we're very tricky creatures. Sometimes they're tricky thoughts like, I'm very tired, or I'm very busy. So those are other ways that we move ourselves away from the work we want to do. So to make, again, this long story short, we want to notice what we're doing. We want to notice what we're saying to ourselves. And if we notice a thought like, boy, this isn't a very interesting novel, we have to dispute that right then and there. And we have to say, sure, not interesting yet. That's why I'm working on it. And then you want to substitute more affirmative language. And it might be something as simple as, I'm staying put. Because the idea of staying put is very powerful. The idea of showing up and staying put is very powerful. So to repeat that, as you say, we will have negative thoughts. They will come up. There'll be many days when we're not happy with what we're working on, or we just wish we were doing something easier, or we just wish we were enjoying the sunshine or something. There'll be many of those days, and we have to notice what we're saying to ourselves and dispute those utterances that don't serve us.
Well, it sounds good, sounds very good. And you do say productive obsessions are different. They are the way that an individual makes meaning and the way that civilization progresses. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. Eric, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I think that most people are rushing around and have not given themselves the chance to reconnect with those early dreams that they had for themselves, those things that they knew they loved back then that have just fallen off the table over time. And so my message is that this is one way to reconnect to those old dreams. The idea of productive obsessions can get you back to the chance to reconnect with dreams that you once had that are worth reconnecting with.
Sounds good. And listeners can find out more about you at brainstormthebook.com, correct?
That's right. And there's also a personal site, ericmaisel.com, and that's ericmaisel.com.
Thank you, Eric Maisel, so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that was Dr. Eric Maisel, his book Brainstorm, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions. And you can find out more about him at brainstormthebook.com. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back, and we'll be joined by dream activist Joyce Chapman.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Want to hear something different from talk radio? The choice is clear. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Well, joining us once again for our Live Your Dream segment is Joyce Chapman. Joyce Chapman is our dream coach. She joins us once a month to answer your questions about living your dream. You can find out more about Joyce at joycechapman.com. Joyce, welcome back to the show.
Hi. It's fun to be back.
So you've got some listener questions.
I have some listener questions, and I'm always excited to be back talking about dreams coming true and answering these questions. So shall we get started?
Let's get started.
Okay. Our first question was from Josie. And she says, "Hi, Joyce. In your Live Your Dream book, you recommend to team up with a dream partner. I'm not sure who to ask. Can you give me some guidelines to help me choose someone to partner up with?" Well, when I first read this question, I thought, sure. Here are five tips to get you started, Josie. And the first thing that I always tell people is make a list of people that you think might be a good dream partner for you. Then take a few minutes and read over your list and pick out the one person that you know would empower you to live your dream. The next step would be to call him or her and talk about what you're learning, discovering by reading my book. You may even want to read that section that's called Team Up with a Dream Partner. Now, as you can guess, my next suggestion is the ideal thing to do would be your dream partner would be, get my book and workbook, and then you could go through the step-by-step program together. And remember, too, that you could always write to me and ask me new questions and get more tips. So good luck with that, and, you know, get started. And dream partnering is an exciting part of all the programs that I recommend, because it just it gives you support that you need. And I believe we all need support. Next question is from Debbie. She says, "I know dreams don't have expiration dates, but how do you know it's time to let go of a dream, tune into a new one? Not giving up, but moving on." As I read this question, I immediately thought of a dream that I'd had, and I knew it wasn't a dream anymore, and I'd let it go. And what I've learned, and I'm guided other people to learn, sometimes we just know it's time to let go of a dream. And other times we need to evaluate and make sure. So to answer Debbie, with this dream, the dream that she's rethinking in mind, I'm going to ask a few questions. Debbie, do you still want this dream to come true? Why are you questioning letting go of this dream? If you had all the money in the world, would you continue to pursue this dream? If you had the help, the support you want and need to keep this dream alive, are you still excited about realizing it? If yes, then your first next step is get busy. If no, move on we have time, I'd love to read an email that Vicki received from a client of mine, Lynn. She says...
We've got just a minute here, so
okay.
If we can do it quickly.
Okay, I could read this quickly. let me just tell you that this is a client that I'll just have a conversation about, that I've worked with for 16 years. And the part that is so exciting to me is that no matter what we discuss, no matter what we talk about, whatever blocks she's experiencing, we just talk it through, and she takes as long as she needs to and practices the journaling, which I recommend to everybody, to add the keeping a personal journal to figure out your questions. And we figure it out together. And that's what I love about dream coaching, that we get to celebrate the learning of a life experience. And lastly, remind you to tune in next month, and we can talk more about, like, how to start a dream circle. And, of course, always send me new questions, visit my website, buy my book, and let's dream together to make this world a world full of dreamers.
And thank you so much, Joyce. Again, Joyce's website is joycechapman.com, and you can send Vicki questions for Joyce at conversationslive.net. We've got to run, but we'll have a brand new show for you next week.